never have occurred to you to open this door to take a look. You don't believe me? I didn't think so. And you don't have to. I want you to maintain your skepticism. It's healthy. But at the same time, I dare you to check me out. Prove me wrong. Put my claim to the test. Walk through that average door just one day in your life. You may end up amazed. Let me explain why. Perfection is man's ultimate illusion. It simply doesn't exist in the universe. There is no perfection. It's really the world's greatest con game. It promises riches and delivers misery. The harder you strive for perfection, the worse your disappointment will become because it's only an abstraction, a concept that doesn't fit reality. Everything can be improved if you look at it closely and critically enough. Every person, every idea, every work of art, every experience, everything. So if you are a perfectionist, you are guaranteed to be a loser in whatever you do. Averageness is another kind of illusion, but it's a benign deception, a useful construct. It's like a slot machine that pays $1.50 for every dollar you put in. It makes you rich on all levels. If you're willing to explore this bizarre-sounding hypothesis, let's begin. But beware, don't let yourself become too average because you may not be used to so much euphoria. After all, a lion can eat only so much meat after the kill. Do you remember Jennifer, the perfectionistic writer student mentioned in Chapter 4? She complained that friends and psychotherapists kept telling her to stop being such a perfectionist, but no one ever bothered to tell her how to go about doing this. This chapter is dedicated to Jennifer. She's not the only one who feels in a quandary about this. At my lectures and workshops, psychotherapists have often asked me to prepare a how-to-do-it manual that illustrates the 15 techniques I have developed for overcoming perfectionism. Well, here's the manual. These methods work. You have nothing to fear or lose because the effects are not irreversible. 1. The best place to begin your fight against perfectionism is with your motivation for maintaining this approach. Make a list of the advantages and disadvantages of being perfectionistic. You may be surprised to learn that it is not actually to your advantage. Once you understand that it does not, in fact, help you in any way, you'll be much more likely to give it up. Jennifer's list is shown in Figure 14.1 on the enhancement. She concluded that her perfectionism was clearly not to her advantage. Now make your list. After you have completed it, read on. 2. Using your list of the advantages and disadvantages of perfectionism, you might want to do some experiments to test some of your assumptions about the advantages. Like many people, you may believe, without my perfectionism, I'd be nothing. I couldn't perform effectively. I'll bet you never put this hypothesis to the test, because your belief in your inadequacy is such an automatic habit, it has never even occurred to you to question it. Did you ever think that maybe you've been as successful as you are in spite of your perfectionism? And not because of it? Here's an experiment that will allow you to come to the truth of the matter. Try altering your standards in various activities so you can see how your performance responds to high standards, middle standards, and low standards. The results may surprise you. I've done this with my writing, my psychotherapy with patients, and my jogging. And in all cases, I have been pleasantly shocked to discover that by lowering my standards, not only do I feel better about what I do, but I tend to do it more effectively. For example, I began jogging in January 1979 for the first time in my life. I live in a very hilly region, and initially I couldn't run more than 200 or 300 yards without having to stop and walk because there are hills in all directions from my driveway. Each day, I made it my aim to run a little less far than the day before. The effect of this was that I could always accomplish my goal easily. Then I would feel so good it would spur me on farther, and every step was gravy, more than I had aimed for. Over a period of months, I built up to the point at which I could run 7 miles over a steep terrain at a fairly rapid pace. I have never abandoned my basic principles to try to accomplish less than the day before. Because of this rule, I never feel frustrated or disappointed in my running. There have been many days when, due to sickness or fatigue, I actually didn't run far or fast. Today, for example, I could only run a quarter mile because I had a cold and my lungs said no farther. So I told myself, this is as far as I was supposed to go. I felt good because I achieved my goal. Try this. Choose any activity, and instead of aiming for 100%, try for 80%, 60%, or 40%. Then see how much you enjoy the activity and how productive you become. Dare to aim at being average. It takes courage, but you may amaze yourself. 3. If you are a compulsive perfectionist, you may believe that without aiming for perfection, you couldn't enjoy life to the maximum or find true happiness. You can put this notion to the test by using the anti-perfectionism sheet, shown in Figure 14.2 on the enhanced portion of this audiobook. Record the actual amount of satisfaction you get from a wide range of activities, such as brushing your teeth, eating an apple, walking in the woods, mowing the lawn, sunbathing, writing a report for work, etc. Now estimate how perfectly you did each activity between 0 and 100%, as well as marking how satisfying each was between 0 and 100%. This will help you break the illusory connection between perfection and satisfaction. Here's how it works. In Chapter 4, I referred to a physician who was convinced he had to be perfect at all times. No matter how much he accomplished, he would always raise his standards slightly higher, and then he'd feel miserable. I told him he was the Philadelphia all-or-nothing thinking champion. He agreed, but protested he didn't know how to change. I persuaded him to do some research on his moods and accomplishments using the anti-perfectionism sheet. One weekend, he did some plumbing at home because a pipe broke and flooded the kitchen. He was a novice plumber, but did manage to fix the leak and clean up the mess. On the sheet, he recorded this as 99% satisfaction. See Figure 14.2 on the enhancement. Since it was the first time he'd ever tried to fix a pipe, he recorded his expertise as only 20%. He got the job done, but it was time-consuming and required considerable guidance from a neighbor. In contrast, he received low degrees of satisfaction from some activities he did an outstanding job on. This experience with the anti-perfectionism sheet persuaded him that he did not have to be perfect at something to enjoy it, and furthermore that striving for perfection and performing exceptionally did not guarantee happiness, but indeed tended to be associated more frequently with less satisfaction. He concluded he could either give up his compulsive drive for perfection and settle for joyous living and high productivity, or make his happiness of secondary importance and constantly push for greatness and settle for emotional anguish and modest productivity. Which would you choose? Try out the anti-perfectionism sheet and put yourself to the test. 4. Let's assume that you've decided to give up your perfectionism at least on a trial basis just to see what happens. However, you have the lingering notion that you really could be perfect in at least some areas if you tried hard enough, and that when you achieve this, something magical will happen. Let's take a hard look at whether this goal is realistic. Does a model of perfection ever really fit reality? Is there anything you have personally encountered that is so perfect it could not be improved? To test this, look around you right now and see how things could be improved. For example, take someone's clothing, a flower arrangement, the color and clarity of a television picture, the quality of a singer's voice, the effectiveness of this chapter, anything at all. I believe you can always find some way in which something could be improved. When I first did this exercise, I was riding on a train. Most things, such as the dirty, rusty old tracks, were so obviously imperfect I could easily find many ways to improve them. Then I came to a problem area. A young black man had his hair in one of those fuzzy naturals. It looked perfectly smooth and sculptured, and I couldn't think of any way it could possibly be improved. I began to panic and saw my whole anti-perfectionist philosophy going down the drain. Then I suddenly noticed some spots of gray on his head. I felt instant relief. His hair was imperfect after all. As I looked more closely, I noticed a few hairs that were too long and out of place. The closer I examined the young man, the more uneven hairs I could see, hundreds, in fact. This helped convince me that any standard of perfection just doesn't fit reality. So why not give it up? You are guaranteed to be a sure loser if you maintain a standard for evaluating your performance that you can't ever meet. Why persecute yourself any longer? 5. Another method for overcoming perfectionism involves a confrontation with fear. You may not be aware that fear always lurks behind perfectionism. Fear is the fuel that drives your compulsion to polish things to the ultimate. If you choose to give up your perfectionism, you may initially have to confront this fear. Are you willing? There is, after all, a payoff in perfectionism. It protects you. It may protect you from risking criticism, failure, or disapproval. If you decide to start doing things less perfectly, at first you may feel as shaky as if a big California earthquake were about to hit. If you don't appreciate the powerful role that fear plays in maintaining perfectionistic habits, the exacting behavior patterns of perfectionistic people can seem incomprehensible or infuriating. There is, for example, a bizarre illness known as compulsive slowness, in which the victim becomes so totally bound up with getting things just right that simple everyday tasks can become totally consuming. An attorney with this brutal disorder became preoccupied with how his hair looked. For hours each day, he would stand before a mirror with a comb and scissors, trying to make adjustments. He became so involved in this, he had to cut back on his legal practice so he could have more and more time to work on his hair. Each day, his hair got shorter and shorter because of all his furious clipping. Eventually, it was only an eighth of an inch long, all over his head. Then, he became preoccupied with balancing the hairline along his forehead, and started shaving it to get it just right. Each day, the hairline receded farther and farther until eventually he had shaved his head totally bald. Then he felt a sense of relief and let it all grow back again, hoping it would come in even. After the hair grew back, he would start clipping it again and the whole cycle would be repeated. This ludicrous routine went on for years and left him a substantially disabled person. His case may seem extreme, but cannot be considered severe. Far worse forms of the disorder exist. Although the victim's strange habits may seem absurd, the effects are tragic. Like alcoholics, these individuals may sacrifice career and family to their miserable compulsions. You too may be paying heavily for your perfectionism. What motivates these exacting, over-controlled individuals? Are they insane? Usually not. What traps them in the senseless drive for perfection is fear. The moment they try to stop what they are doing, they are gripped by a powerful uneasiness that rapidly escalates to raw terror. This drives them back to their compulsive ritual in a pathetic attempt to find relief. Getting them to give up their perfectionistic malignancy is like trying to persuade a man hanging by his fingers from the edge of a cliff to let go. You may have noticed compulsive tendencies in yourself to a much less severe degree. Have you ever pushed relentlessly to look for an important item like a pencil or a key you misplaced when you knew it was best to forget about it and wait for it to show up? You do this because it's tough to stop. The moment you try, you become uneasy and nervous. You feel somehow not right without the lost item, as if the whole meaning of your life were in the balance. One method of confronting and conquering this fear is called response prevention. The basic principle is simple and obvious. You refuse to give in to the perfectionistic habit, and you allow yourself to become flooded with fear and discomfort. Stubbornly stick it out, and do not give in, no matter how upset you become. Hang in there and allow your upset to reach its maximum. After a period of time, the compulsion will begin to diminish until it disappears completely. At this point, which might require as much as several hours or as little as 10 to 15 minutes, you have won. You've defeated your compulsive habit. Let's take a simple example. Suppose you are in the habit of double-checking the house or car locks several times. Certainly it's okay to check things once, but more often than that is redundant and pointless. Drive your car to a parking lot, lock the doors, and walk away. Now, refuse to check them. You will feel uneasy. You'll try to persuade yourself to go back and just make sure. Don't. Instead, record your degree of anxiety every minute on the response prevention form, found in Figure 14.3 on the enhancement, until the anxiety has vanished. At this point, you win. Often, one such exposure is sufficient to break a habit permanently, or you may need numerous exposures as well as a booster shot from time to time. Many bad habits lend themselves to this format, including various checking rituals, checking to see if the stove is turned off or if the mail has fallen into the mailbox, etc., cleaning rituals, compulsive hand washing or excessive house cleaning, and others. If you are ready and willing to break free of these tendencies, I think you'll find the response prevention technique quite helpful. 6. You may be asking yourself about the origin of the crazy fear that drives you to compulsive perfectionizing. You can use the vertical arrow method described in Chapter 10 to expose the silent assumption that causes your rigid, tense approach to living. Fred is a college student who was so preoccupied with getting a term paper just right that he dropped out of college to work on it for an entire year to avoid the horrors of turning in a product he wasn't entirely satisfied with. Fred finally enrolled in college again when he felt ready to turn the paper in, but sought treatment for his perfectionism because he realized it might take too long to complete college this way. He had his confrontation with fear when he was required to turn in another term paper at the end of his first semester back in school. This time, the professor gave him the ultimatum of either turning it in by 6 p.m. on the due date or getting docked one full grade for every day it was late. Since Fred had an adequate draft of the paper, he realized it wouldn't be wise for him to try to polish it and revise it. So he reluctantly turned it in at 4:55, knowing that there were a number of uncorrected typographical errors, as well as some sections he wasn't entirely satisfied with. The moment he turned it in, his anxiety began to mount. Minute by minute it increased, and soon Fred was gripped by such a severe panic attack that he called me at home late in the evening. He was convinced that something terrible was about to happen to him because he had turned in an imperfect paper. I suggested he use the vertical arrow method to pinpoint just what he was so afraid of. His first automatic thought was, "I didn't do an excellent job on the paper." He wrote this down and then asked himself, "If that were true, why would it be a problem for me?" This question generated the upsetting thought lurking behind it, as demonstrated in Figure 14.4, found on the enhanced portion of this audiobook. Fred wrote down the next thought that came to mind and continued to use the downward arrow technique to reveal his fears at a deeper and deeper level. He continued peeling the layers off the onion in this way until the deepest origin of his panic and perfectionism was uncovered. This required only a few minutes. His silent assumption then became obvious. 1. One mistake and my career will be ruined. 2. Others demand perfection and success from me and will ostracize me if I fall short. Once he wrote down his upsetting automatic thoughts, he was in a position to pinpoint his thinking errors. 3 distortions appeared most often: all-or-nothing thinking, mind-reading, and the fortune-teller error. These distortions had trapped him in a rigid, coercive, perfectionistic, approval-seeking approach to life. Substituting rational responses helped him recognize how unrealistic his fears were and took the edge off his panic. Fred was skeptical, however, because he wasn't entirely convinced a catastrophe was not about to strike. He needed some actual evidence to be convinced. Since he'd been keeping the elephants away by blowing the trumpet all his life, he couldn't be absolutely sure a stampede wouldn't occur once he decided to set the trumpet down. 2 days later, Fred got the needed evidence. He picked up his paper, and there was an A- at the top. The typographical errors had been corrected by the professor, who wrote a thoughtful note at the end that contained substantial praise, along with some helpful suggestions. If you are going to let go of your perfectionism, then you may also have to expose yourself to a certain amount of initial unpleasantness, just as Fred did. This can be your golden opportunity to learn about the origin of your fears using the vertical arrow technique. Rather than run from your fear, sit still and confront the bogeyman. Ask yourself, "What am I afraid of? What's the worst that could happen?" Then write down your automatic thoughts, as Fred did, and call their bluff. It will be frightening, but if you tough it out and endure the discomfort, you will conquer your fears because they are ultimately based on illusions. The exhilaration you experience when you make this transformation from worrier to warrior can be the start of a more confident, assertive approach to living. The thought may have occurred to you, but suppose Fred did end up with a B, C, D, or an F. What then? In reality, this usually doesn't happen because in your perfectionism, you are in the habit of leaving yourself such an excessively wide margin of safety that you can usually relax your efforts considerably without a measurable reduction in the quality of the actual performance. However, failures can and do occur in life, and none of us is totally immune. It can be useful to prepare ahead of time for this possibility so that you can benefit from the experience. You can do this if you set things up in a can't-lose fashion. How can you benefit from such an actual failure? It's simple. You remind yourself that your life won't be destroyed. Getting a B, in fact, is one of the best things that can happen to you if you are a straight-A student, because it will force you to confront and accept your humanness. This will lead to personal growth. The real tragedy occurs when a student is so bright and compulsive that he or she successfully wards off any chance of failure through overwhelming personal effort and ends up graduating with a perfect straight-A average. The paradox in this situation is that success has a dangerous effect of turning these students into cripples or slaves whose lives become obsessively rigid attempts to ward off the fear of being less than perfect. Their careers are rich in achievement, but frequently impoverished in joy. 7. Another method for overcoming perfectionism involves developing a process orientation. This means you focus on processes rather than outcomes as a basis for evaluating things. When I first opened my practice, I had the feeling I had to do outstanding work with each patient every session. I thought my patients and peers expected this of me, and so I worked my tail off all day long. When a patient indicated he benefited from a session, I'd tell myself I was successful, and I'd feel on top of the world. In contrast, when a patient gave me the runaround or responded negatively to that day's session, I'd feel miserable and tell myself I had failed. I got tired of the roller coaster effect and reviewed the problem with my colleague, Dr. Beck. His comments were extremely helpful, so I'll pass them on to you. He suggested, I imagine I had a job driving a car to City Hall each day. Some days I'd hit mostly green lights and I'd make fast time. Other days I'd hit a lot of red lights and traffic jams, and the trip would take much longer. My driving skill would be the same each day, so why not feel equally satisfied with the job I did? He proposed I could facilitate this new way of looking at things by refusing to try to do an excellent job with any patient. Instead, I could aim for a good, consistent effort at each session, regardless of how the patient responded, and in this way I could guarantee 100% success forever. How could you set up process goals as a student? You could make it your aim to 1. Attend lectures, 2. Pay attention and take notes, 3. Ask appropriate questions, 4. Study each course between classes a certain amount each day, 5. Review class study notes every 2 or 3 weeks. All these processes are within your control, so you can guarantee success. In contrast, your final grade is not under your control. It depends on how the professor feels that day, how well the other students did, where he sets the curve, etc. How could you set up process goals if you were applying for a job? You could, 1. Dress in a confident, appealing manner. 2. Have your resume edited by a knowledgeable friend and typed professionally. 3. Give the prospective employer 1 or more compliments during the interview. 4. Express an interest in the company and encourage the interviewer to talk about himself. 5. When the prospective employer tells you about his work, say something positive, using an upbeat approach. 6. If the interviewer makes a critical or negative comment about you, immediately agree, using the disarming technique introduced in Chapter 6. For example, in my negotiations with the prospective publisher about this book, I noticed the editor expressed a number of negative reactions, in addition to a few positive ones. I found the use of the disarming technique worked extremely well in keeping the waters flowing non-turbulently during potentially difficult discussions. For example, Editor X. One of my concerns, Dr. Burns, involves the emphasis on symptomatic improvement in the here and now. Aren't you overlooking the causes and origins of depressions? In the first draft of this book, I had written several chapters on the silent assumptions that give rise to depression. But apparently the editor was not adequately impressed with this material or had not read it. I had the option of counterattacking in a defensive manner, which would have only polarized the editor and made her feel defensive. Instead, I chose to disarm her in the following way. David, that's an excellent suggestion, and you're absolutely right. I can see you've been doing your homework on the manuscript, and I appreciate hearing about your ideas. The readers obviously would want to learn more about why they get depressed. This might help them avoid future depressions. What would you think about expanding the section on silent assumptions and introducing it with a new chapter we could call Getting Down to Root Causes? Editor, that sounds great. What other negative reactions do you have to the book? I'd like to learn as much as I can from you. I then continued to find a way to agree with each criticism and to praise Editor X for each and every suggestion. This was not insincere because I was a greenhorn in popular writing, and Editor X was a very talented, well-established individual who was in a position to give me some much-needed guidance. My negotiating style made it clear to her that I respected her and let her know that we would be able to have a productive working relationship. Suppose instead that I had been fixed on the outcome rather than on the negotiating process when the editor interviewed me. I would have been tense and preoccupied with only one thing. Would she or would she not make an offer for the book? Then I would have seen her every criticism as a danger, and the whole interpersonal process would have fallen into unpleasant focus. Thus, when you are applying for work, do not make it your aim to get the job, especially if you want the job. The outcome depends on numerous factors that are ultimately out of your control, including the number of applicants, their qualifications, who knows the boss's daughter, etc. In fact, you would do better to try to get as many rejections as possible for the following reason. Suppose on the average it takes about 10 to 15 interviews for each acceptable job offer you receive in your profession. A typical batting average for people I know who have been recently looking for work. This means you've got to go out and get those 9 to 14 rejections over with in order to get the job you want. So, each morning say, I'll try to get as many rejections as possible today. And each time you do get rejected, you can say, I was successfully rejected. This brings me one important step closer to my goal. 8. Another way to overcome perfectionism involves assuming responsibility for your life by setting strict time limits on all your activities for 1 week. This will help you change your perspective so you can focus on the flow of life and enjoy it. If you are a perfectionist, you are probably a real procrastinator because you insist on doing things so thoroughly. The secret to happiness is to set modest goals to accomplish them. If you want misery, then by all means, cling to your perfectionism and procrastination. If you would like to change, then as you schedule your day in the morning, decide on the amount of time you will budget on each activity. Quit at the end of the time you have set aside, whether or not you have completed it, and go on to the next project. If you play the piano and intend to play for many hours or not at all, decide instead to play only an hour a day. I think you'll enhance your satisfaction and output substantially this way. 9. I'll bet you're afraid of making mistakes. What's so terrible about making mistakes? Will the world come to an end if you're wrong? Show me the man who can't stand to be wrong, and I'll show you a man who is afraid to take risks and has given up the capacity for growth. A particularly powerful method for defeating perfectionism involves learning to make mistakes. Here's how you can do this. Write an essay in which you spell out why it is both irrational and self-defeating to try to be perfect or to fear making mistakes. The following was written by Jennifer, the student mentioned earlier. Why it's great to be able to make mistakes. 1. I fear making mistakes because I see everything in absolutist, perfectionistic terms. One mistake and the whole is ruined. This is erroneous. A small mistake certainly doesn't ruin an otherwise fine whole. 2. It's good to make mistakes because then we learn. In fact, we won't learn unless we make mistakes. No one can avoid making mistakes, and since it's going to happen in any case, we may as well accept it and learn from it. 3. Recognizing our mistakes helps us to adjust our behavior so that we can get results we're more pleased with. So we might say that mistakes ultimately operate to make us happier and make things better. 4. If we fear making mistakes, we become paralyzed. We're afraid to do or try anything since we might, in fact, probably will, make some mistakes. If we restrict our activities so that we won't make mistakes, then we are really defeating ourselves. The more we try and the more mistakes we make, the faster we'll learn and the happier we'll be ultimately. 5. Most people aren't going to be mad at us or dislike us because we make mistakes. They all make mistakes, and most people feel uncomfortable around perfect people. 6. We don't die if we make mistakes. Although such an essay does not guarantee that you will change, it can help you get started in the right direction. Jennifer reported an enormous improvement the week after she wrote the essay. She found it useful in her studies to focus on learning rather than obsessing constantly about whether or not she was great. As a result, her anxiety decreased and her ability to get things done increased. This relaxed, confident mood persisted through the final examination period at the end of the first semester, a time of extreme anxiety for the majority of her classmates. As she explained, "I realized I didn't have to be perfect. I'm going to make my share of mistakes. So what? I can learn from my mistakes, so there's nothing to worry about." And she was right. Write a memo to yourself along these lines. Remind yourself that the world won't come to an end if you make a mistake, and point out the potential benefits. Then read the memo every morning for 2 weeks. I think this will go a long way toward helping you join the human race. 10. In your perfectionism, you are undoubtedly great at focusing on all the ways you fall short. You have the bad habit of picking out the things you haven't done and ignoring those you have. You spend your life cataloging every mistake and shortcoming. No wonder you feel inadequate. Is somebody forcing you to do this? Do you like feeling that way? Here's a simple method of reversing this absurd and painful tendency. Use your wrist counter to click off the things you do right each day. See how many points you can accumulate. This may sound so unsophisticated that you are convinced it couldn't help you. If so, experiment with it for 2 weeks. I predict you'll discover that you will begin to focus more on the positives in your life and will consequently feel better about yourself. It sounds simplistic because it is. But who cares if it works? 11. Another helpful method involves exposing the absurdity in the all-or-nothing thinking that gives rise to your perfectionism. Look around you and ask yourself, how many things in the world can be broken down into all-or-nothing categories? Are the walls around you totally clean? Or do they have at least some dirt? Am I totally effective with all of my writing? Or partially effective? Certainly every single paragraph of this book isn't polished to perfection and breathtakingly helpful. Do you know anyone who is totally calm and confident all the time? Is your favorite movie star perfectly beautiful? Once you recognize that all-or-nothing thinking doesn't fit reality very often, then look out for your all-or-nothing thoughts throughout the day. And when you notice one, talk back to it and shoot it down. You'll feel better. Some examples of how a number of different individuals combat all-or-nothing thoughts appear in Figure 14.5 on the enhancement. 12. The next method to combat perfectionism involves personal disclosure. If you feel nervous or inadequate in a situation, then share it with people. Point out the things you feel you've done inadequately instead of covering them up. Ask people for suggestions on how to improve, and if they're going to reject you for being imperfect, let them do it and get it over with. If in doubt as to where you stand, ask if they think less of you when you make a mistake. If you do this, you must, of course, be prepared to handle the possibility that people will look down on you because of your imperfections. This actually happened to me during a teaching session I was conducting for a group of therapists. I pointed out an error I felt I had made in reacting angrily to a difficult, manipulative patient. I then asked if any of the therapists present thought less of me after hearing about my foible. I was taken aback when one replied in the affirmative and the following conversation took place. Therapist in the audience. I have two thoughts. One thought is a positive one. I appreciate your taking that risk to point out your error in front of the group because I would have been scared to do it. I think it takes great courage on your part to do this, but I have to admit I'm ambivalent about you now. Now I know that you do make mistakes, which is realistic, but I feel disappointed in you. In all honesty, I do. David. Well, I knew how to handle the patient, but I was so overcome with my anger that I just got caught up in the moment and retaliated. I was overly abrupt in the way I reacted to her. I admit I handled it quite poorly. I guess in the context that you see so many patients each week for so many years, if you make one blunder like that, it's definitely not earth-shattering. It's not going to kill her or anything. But I do feel let down, I have to admit. But it isn't just one rare error. I believe that all therapists make many blunders every single day, either obvious ones or subtle ones. At least I do. How will you come to terms with that? It seems you're quite disappointed in me because I didn't handle that patient effectively. Well, I am. I thought you had a sufficiently wide behavioral repertoire that you could easily handle nearly anything a patient said to you. Well, that's untrue. I sometimes come up with very helpful things to say in difficult situations. but sometimes I'm not as effective as I'd like to be. I still have a lot to learn. Now, with that knowledge, do you think less of me? Yeah, I really do. I have to say that, because now I see that there's a reasonably easy kind of conflict that can upset you. You were unable to handle it without showing your vulnerabilities. That's true. At least that time I didn't handle it well. It's an area where I need to focus my efforts and grow as a therapist. Well, it shows that at least in that case, and I assume in others, that you don't handle things as well as I thought you did. I think that's correct. But the question is, why do you think less of me because I am imperfect? Why are you looking down on me? Does it make me less a person to you? You're exaggerating the whole thing now, and I don't feel that you are necessarily of less value as a human or anything like that. But on the other hand, I think you're not as good as a therapist as I thought you were. That's true. Do you think less of me because of that? As a therapist? As a therapist or as a person, do you think less of me? Yes, I suppose I do. Why? Well, I don't know how to say this. I think therapist is the primary role that I know you in. I'm disappointed to find you're so imperfect. I had a higher expectation of you, but perhaps you're better in other areas of your life. I hate to disappoint you, but you'll discover that in many other aspects of my life, I'm even more imperfect. So if you're looking down on me as a therapist, I presume you'll look down on me more as a person. Well, I do think less of you as a person. I think that's an accurate description of how I'm feeling about you. Why do you think less of me? Because I don't measure up to your standard of perfection? I'm a human and not a robot. I'm not sure I understand that question. I judge people in terms of their performance. You goofed up, so you have to face the fact I'll judge you negatively. It's tough, but it's reality. I thought you should perform better because you're our preceptor and our teacher. I expected more of you. Now it sounds like I could have handled that patient better than you did. Well, I think you could have done better than I did with that patient that day, and this is an area where I think I can learn from you. But why do you look down on me for this? If you get disappointed and lose respect each time you notice I've made a mistake, pretty soon you'll be totally miserable, and you'll have no respect for me at all because I've been making errors every day since I was born. Do you want all that discomfort? If you want to continue and enjoy our friendship, and I hope you will, you'll just have to accept the fact that I'm not perfect. Maybe you'd be willing to look for mistakes I make and point them out to me so I can learn from you while I'm teaching you. When I stop making mistakes, I'll lose much of my capacity to grow. Recognizing and correcting my errors and learning from them is one of my greatest assets. And if you can accept my humanity and imperfection, maybe you can also accept your own. Maybe you'll want to feel that it's okay for you to make mistakes too. This kind of dialogue transcends the possibility you will feel put down. Asserting your right to make mistakes will paradoxically make you a greater human being. If the other person feels disappointed, the fault is really his for having set up the unrealistic expectation you are more than human. If you don't buy into that foolish expectation, you won't have to become angry or defensive when you do goof up, nor will you have to feel any sense of shame or embarrassment. The choice is clear-cut. You can either try to be perfect and end up miserable, or you can aim to be human and imperfect and feel enhanced. Which do you choose? 13. The next method is to focus mentally on a time in your life when you were really happy. What image comes to mind? For me, the image is of climbing down into Havasupai Canyon one summer vacation when I was a college student. This canyon is an isolated part of the Grand Canyon, and you have to hike into it or arrange for horses. I went with a friend. Havasupai, an Indian word meaning blue-green water people, is the name of a turquoise river that bubbles out of the desert floor and turns the narrow canyon into a lush paradise many miles long. Ultimately, the Havasupai River empties into the Colorado River. There are a number of waterfalls several hundred feet high, and at the bottom of each, a green chemical in the water precipitates out and makes the river's bottom and edges smooth and polished, just like a turquoise swimming pool. Cottonwood trees and jimson weed with purple flowers like trumpets line the river in abundance. The Indians who live there are easygoing and friendly. It is a blissful memory. Perhaps you have a similar happy memory. Now ask yourself, what was perfect about that experience? In my case, nothing. There were no toilet facilities, and we slept in sleeping bags outdoors. I didn't hike perfectly or swim perfectly, and nothing was perfect. There was no electricity available in most of the village because of its remoteness, and the only available food in the store was canned beans and fruit cocktail, no meat or vegetables. But the food tasted darn good after a day of hiking and swimming, so who needs perfection? How can you use such a happy memory? When you are having a presumably pleasurable experience, eating out, taking a trip, going to a movie, etc., you may unnecessarily sour the experience by making an inventory of all the ways it falls short and telling yourself you can't possibly enjoy it. But this is hogwash. It's your expectation that upsets you. Suppose the motel bed is too lumpy and you paid $56 for the room. You call the front desk and they have no other beds or rooms available. Tough. Now you can double your trouble by demanding perfection, or you can conjure up your happy imperfect memory. Remember the time you camped out and slept on the ground and loved it? So you can certainly enjoy yourself in this motel room if you choose. Again, it's up to you. 14. Another method for overcoming perfectionism is the greed technique. This is based on the simple fact that most of us try to be perfect so we can get ahead in life. It may not have occurred to you that you might end up much more successful if your standards were lower. For example, when I started my academic career, I spent over 2 years writing the first research paper I published. It was an excellent product, and I'm still quite proud of it. But I noticed that in the same time period, many of my peers who were of equal intelligence wrote and published numerous papers. So I asked myself, am I better off with one publication that contains 98 units of excellence, or 10 papers that are each worth only 80 units of excellence? In the latter case, I would actually end up with 800 excellence units, and I would be way ahead of the game. This realization was a strong personal persuader, and I decided to lower my standards a bit. My productivity then became dramatically enhanced, as well as my levels of satisfaction. How can this work for you? Suppose you have a task and you notice you're moving slowly. You may find that you've already reached the point of diminishing returns, and you'd do better by moving on to the next task. I'm not advocating that you slough off, but you may find that you, as well as others, will be equally, if not more pleased, with many good, solid performances than with one stress-producing masterpiece. 15. Here's the last approach. It involves simple logic. Premise 1. All human beings make mistakes. Do you agree? Okay, now tell me, what are you? A human being, you say? Okay. Now, what follows? Of course, you will and should make mistakes. Now tell yourself this every time you persecute yourself because you made an error. Just say, I was supposed to make that mistake because I'm human. Or, how human of me to have made that mistake. In addition, ask yourself, what can I learn from my mistake? Is there some good that could come from this? As an experiment, think about some error you've made and write down everything you learned from it. Some of the best things can be learned only through making mistakes and learning from them. After all, this is how you learn to talk and walk and do just about everything. Would you be willing to give up that kind of growth? You may even go so far as to say your imperfections and goof-ups are some of your greatest assets. Cherish them. Never give up your capacity for being wrong, because then you lose the ability to move forward. In fact, just think what it would be like if you were perfect. There'd be nothing to learn, no way to improve, and life would be completely void of challenge and the satisfaction that comes from mastering something that takes effort. It would be like going to kindergarten for the rest of your life. You'd know all the answers and win every game. Every project would be a guaranteed success because you would do everything correctly. People's conversations would offer you nothing because you'd already know it all. And most important, nobody could love or relate to you. It would be impossible to feel any love for someone who was flawless and knew it all. Doesn't that sound lonely, boring, and miserable? Are you so sure you still want perfection? Part 5. Defeating Hopelessness and Suicide. Chapter 15. The Ultimate Victory, Choosing to Live. Dr. Aaron T. Beck reported in a study that suicidal wishes were present in approximately one-third of individuals with a mild case of depression, and to nearly three-quarters of people who are severely depressed. It has been estimated that as many as 5% of depressed patients do actually die as a result of suicide. This is approximately 25 times the suicide rate within the general population. In fact, when a person with a depressive illness dies, the chances are 1 in 6 that suicide was the cause of death. No age group or social or professional class is exempt from suicide. Think of the famous people you know of who have killed themselves. Particularly shocking and grotesque, but by no means rare, is suicide among the very young. In a study of 7th and 8th grade students in a suburban Philadelphia parochial school, nearly one-third of the youngsters were significantly depressed and had suicidal thoughts. Even infants who undergo maternal separation can develop a depressive syndrome in which failure to thrive and even self-imposed death from starvation can result. Before you get overwhelmed, let me emphasize the positive side of the coin. First, suicide is unnecessary, and the impulse can be rapidly overcome and eliminated with cognitive techniques. In our study, suicidal urges were reduced substantially in patients treated with cognitive therapy or with antidepressant drugs. The improved outlook on life occurred within the first week or two of treatment in many cognitively treated patients. The current intensive emphasis on the prevention of depressive episodes in individuals prone to mood swings should also result in a long-term reduction in suicidal impulses. Why do depressed individuals so frequently think of suicide? And what can be done to prevent these impulses? You will understand this if you examine the thinking of people who are actively suicidal. A pervasive, pessimistic vision dominates their thoughts. Life seems to be nothing but a hellish nightmare. As they look into the past, all they can remember are moments of depression and suffering. When you feel down in the dumps, you may also feel so low at times that you get the feeling you were never really happy, and never will be. If a friend or relative points out to you that, except for such periods of depression, you were quite happy, you may conclude they're mistaken or only trying to cheer you up. This is because while you are depressed, you actually distort your memories of the past. You just can't conjure up any memories of periods of satisfaction or joy, so you erroneously conclude they did not exist. Thus, you mistakenly conclude that you always have been and always will be miserable. If someone insists that you have been happy, you may respond as a young patient recently did in my office. Well, that period of time doesn't count. Happiness is an illusion of some kind. The real me is depressed and inadequate. I was just fooling myself if I thought I was happy. No matter how bad you feel, it would be bearable if you had the conviction that things would eventually improve. The critical decision to commit suicide results from your illogical conviction that your mood can't improve. You feel certain that the future holds only more pain and turmoil. Like some depressed patients, you may be able to support your pessimistic prediction with a wealth of data which seems to you to be overwhelmingly convincing. A depressed 49-year-old stockbroker recently told me, "Doctor, I have already been treated by 6 psychiatrists over a 10-year period. I've had shock treatments and all types of antidepressants, tranquilizers, and other drugs. But in spite of it all, this depression won't let up for 1 minute. I have spent over $80,000 trying to get well. Now I am emotionally and financially depleted. Every doctor has said to me, 'You'll beat this thing, keep your chin up.' But now I realize it wasn't true. They were all lying to me. I'm a fighter, so I fought hard. You better realize when you were defeated. I've got to admit I'd be better off dead." Research studies have shown that your unrealistic sense of hopelessness is one of the most crucial factors in the development of a serious suicidal wish. Because of your twisted thinking, you see yourself in a trap from which there seems to be no escape. You jump to the conclusion that your problems are insoluble. Because your suffering feels unbearable and appears unending, you may erroneously conclude that suicide is your only way of escape. If you have had such thoughts in the past, or if you are seriously thinking this way at present, let me state the message of this chapter loud and clear. You are wrong in your belief that suicide is the only solution or the best solution to your problem. Let me repeat that. You are wrong. When you think that you are trapped and hopeless, your thinking is illogical, distorted, and skewed. no matter how thoroughly you have convinced yourself, and even if you get other people to agree with you, you are just plain mistaken in your belief that it is ever advisable to commit suicide because of depressive illness. This is not the most rational solution to your misery. I will explain this position and help point the way out of the suicide trap. Assessing your suicidal impulses. Although suicidal thoughts are common even in individuals who are not depressed, the occurrence of a suicidal impulse, if you are depressed, is always to be regarded as a dangerous symptom. It is important for you to know how to pinpoint those suicidal impulses which are the most threatening. In the Burns Depression Checklist in Chapter 2, questions 23, 24, and 25 refer to your suicidal thoughts and impulses. If you have checked a 1, 2, 3, or 4 on these questions, suicidal fantasies are present, and it is important to evaluate their seriousness and to intervene if necessary. See page 21 on the enhancement. The most serious error you could make with regard to your suicidal impulses is to be overly inhibited in talking them over with a counselor. Many people are afraid to talk about suicidal fantasies and urges for fear of disapproval or because they believe that even talking about them will bring on a suicide attempt. This point of view is unwarranted. You are more likely to feel a great sense of relief in discussing suicidal thoughts with a professional therapist, and consequently, you have a much better chance of diffusing them. If you do have suicidal thoughts, ask yourself if you are taking such thoughts seriously. Are there times when you wish you were dead? If the answer is yes, is your death wish active or passive? A passive death wish exists if you would prefer to be dead, but you are unwilling to take active steps to bring this about. One young man confessed to me, "Doctor, every night when I go to bed, I pray to God to let me wake up with cancer. Then I could die in peace and my family would understand." An active death wish is more dangerous. If you are seriously planning an actual suicide attempt, then it's important to know the following. Have you thought about a method? What is your method? Have you made plans? What specific preparations have you made? As a general rule, the more concrete and well-formulated your plans are, the more likely you may actually make a suicide attempt. The time to seek professional help is now. Have you ever made a suicide attempt in the past? If so, you should view any suicidal impulse as a danger signal to seek help immediately. For many people, these previous attempts seem to be warm-ups in which they flirt with suicide but have not mastered the particular method they have selected. The fact that an individual has made this attempt unsuccessfully on several occasions in the past indicates an increased risk of success in the future. It is a dangerous myth that unsuccessful suicide attempts are simply gestures or attention-getting devices and are therefore not to be taken seriously. Current thinking suggests that all suicidal thoughts or actions are to be taken seriously. It can be highly misleading to view suicidal thoughts and actions as a plea for help. Many suicidal patients want help least of all because they are 100% convinced they are hopeless and beyond help. Because of this illogical belief, what they really want is death. Your degree of hopelessness is of the greatest importance in assessing whether or not you are at risk for making an active suicide attempt at any time. This one factor seems more closely linked with actual suicide attempts than any other. You must ask yourself, do I believe that I have absolutely no chance of getting better? Do I feel that I have exhausted all treatment possibilities and that nothing could possibly help? Do I feel convinced beyond all doubt that my suffering is unbearable and could never come to an end? If you answer yes to these questions, then your degree of hopelessness is high and professional treatment is indicated now. I would like to emphasize that hopelessness is as much a symptom of depression as a cough is a symptom of pneumonia. The feeling of hopelessness does not, in fact, prove that you are hopeless any more than a cough proves you are doomed to succumb to pneumonia. It just proves that you are suffering from an illness, in this case, depression. This sense of hopelessness is not a reason to make a suicide attempt, but gives you a clear signal to seek competent treatment. So if you feel hopeless, seek help. Do not consider suicide for one more minute. The last important factor concerns deterrence. Ask yourself, is there anything that is preventing me from committing suicide? Would I hold back because of my family, friends, or religious beliefs? If you have no deterrence, the possibility is greater that you would consider an actual suicide attempt. Summary. If you are suicidal, it is of great importance for you to evaluate these impulses in a matter-of-fact manner, using your common sense. The following factors put you in a high-risk group. 1. If you are severely depressed and feel hopeless. 2. If you have a past history of suicide attempts. 3. If you have made concrete plans and preparations for suicide. And 4. If no deterrents are holding you back. If one or more of these factors apply to you, then it is vital to get professional intervention and treatment immediately. While I firmly believe that the attitude of self-help is important for all people with depression, you clearly must seek professional guidance right away. The illogic of suicide. Do you think depressed people have the right to commit suicide? Some misguided individuals and novice therapists are unduly concerned with this issue. If you are counseling or trying to help a chronically depressed individual who is hopeless and threatening self-destruction, you may ask yourself, should I intervene aggressively or should I let him go ahead? What are his rights as a human being in this regard? Am I responsible for preventing this attempt, or should I tell him to go ahead and exercise his freedom of choice? I regard this as an absurd and cruel issue that misses the point entirely. The real question is not whether a depressed individual has the right to commit suicide, but whether he is realistic in his thoughts when he is considering it. When I talk to a suicidal person, I try to find out why he is feeling that way. I might ask, what is your motive for wanting to kill yourself? What problem in your life is so terrible that there is no solution? Then I would help that person expose the illogical thinking that lurks behind the suicidal impulse as quickly as possible. When you begin to think more realistically, your sense of hopelessness and the desire to end your life will fade away and you will have the urge to live. Thus, I recommend joy rather than death to suicidal individuals, and I try to show them how to achieve it as fast as possible. Let's see how this can be done. Holly was a 19-year-old woman who was referred to me for treatment by a child psychoanalyst in New York City. He had treated her unsuccessfully with analytic therapy for many years, since the onset of a severe unremitting depression in her early teens. Other doctors had also been unable to help her. Her depression originated during a period of family turbulence that led to her parents' separation and divorce. Holly's chronic blue mood was punctuated by numerous wrist-slashing episodes. She said that when periods of frustration and hopelessness would build up, she would be overcome by the urge to rip into her flesh and would experience relief only when she saw the blood flowing across her skin. When I first met Holly, I noticed a mass of white scar tissue across her wrists that attested to this behavior. In addition to these episodes of self-mutilation, which were not suicide attempts, she had tried to kill herself on a number of occasions. In spite of all the treatment she had received, her depression would not let up. At times it became so severe that she had to be hospitalized. Holly had been confined to a closed ward of a New York hospital for several months at the time she was referred to me. The referring doctor recommended a minimum of 3 years of additional continuous hospitalization and appeared to agree with Holly that her prognosis for substantial improvement, at least in the near future, was poor. Ironically, she was bright, articulate, and personable. She had done well in high school, in spite of being unable to go to classes during the times she was confined to hospitals. She had to take some courses with the help of tutors. Like a number of adolescent patients, Holly's dream was to become a mental health professional. But she had been told by her previous therapist that this was unrealistic because of the nature of her own explosive, intractable emotional problems. This opinion was just one more crushing blow for Holly. After graduation from high school, she spent the majority of her time in inpatient mental hospital facilities because she was considered too ill and uncontrollable for outpatient therapy. In a desperate attempt to find help, her father contacted the University of Pennsylvania because he had read about our work in depression. He requested a consultation to determine whether any promising treatment alternatives existed for his daughter. After speaking to me by phone, Holly's father obtained custody of her and drove to Philadelphia so that I could talk to her and review the possibilities for treatment. When I met them, their personalities contrasted with my expectations. He proved to be a relaxed, mild-mannered individual. She was strikingly attractive, pleasant, and cooperative. I administered several psychological tests to Holly. The Beck Depression Inventory indicated severe depression, and other tests confirmed a high degree of hopelessness and serious suicidal intent. Holly put it to me bluntly, "I want to kill myself." The family history indicated that several relatives had attempted suicide, two of them successfully. When I asked Holly why she wanted to kill herself, she told me